The Jay Young Show is a weekly podcast featuring insightful discussions with anyone from big business CEOs, celebrities, to military heroes. Each interview is a personal conversation about business, life, and anything in between. And now, your host, Jay Young.
Now, what I want to do is you're out of hedge fund business now, and you're in the family office business. And I mean, family office business was kind of confusing to me at first, because I'm thinking family office, but tell me what a family office is. Kind of explain it, because I can, but you can do so much better than me, because you're obviously living it, managing it. But what is a family office, and what do they do?
Yeah, so a family office, and you're absolutely right. You know, the joke in family office world is, if you've seen one family office, you've seen one family office, right? And that's because every single family is different. They made their money in different ways, in different industries. They invest differently. They spend differently. Their lifestyle is different. The family itself may be a small nuclear family or five generations of family members. But at the end of the day, you know, years ago, somebody came up with this concept of a very, very wealthy family decided they were going to set up their own office, and it would manage all of their affairs, not just their finances, not just paying their bills and investing this you know, large sum of wealth, but also thinking about things like, you know, day to day, you know, having executive assistants to help them book travel and do personal shopping. They would have accountants and tax professionals to make sure that they were doing everything they possibly could to maximize their return. You know, they would, you know, bring in investment professionals, people from hedge funds and other investment vehicles, to help them be the smartest investor that they could possibly be. And so that was really the early family offices were what we call single family offices. So it was one big family, and they would set up their own office, and they would, you know, have office space, and then they would hire specific people to help them with their needs. Then I'd say, you know, some years ago, someone had this epiphany, and I wish it was me, but now I'm the benefit of it, which is that, okay, you know, obviously a family that's got a couple of $1 million in the bank doesn't need their own family office. Certainly someone with a couple of $1 billion does, and they've got plenty of resources in order to pay for that. But what about those people who are kind of in the middle, right? The people that have done well, maybe they have anywhere from 25 million up to a billion. And so they've got a lot of wealth, but not enough to maybe warrant them going out and setting up an office dedicated to just them. So somebody came up with this concept of a multifamily office. So instead of one family, let's have 10 families or 20 families together. And then, you know, we can have more employees, and we can have more subject matter experts. And then the expenses of all of those people and services and technology, they get shared across those families, which makes it way more efficient. So the family with 300 million ends up effectively getting the same, if not better, coverage and service, but they're doing it for less of a, you know, a smaller price, if you will. So I joined this incredible company, Verdant Capital Advisors, and I'm running their multifamily office. So, you know, we've got about 18 families, about 1.4 billion of our 3.2 billion under management is in our multifamily office. And we're doing a lot of the things that I mentioned. You know, we're helping our clients recapture their time through, you know, helping them do tax prep work and working with that accounting firm. We have a team of concierge, you know, folks that do those personal services that they would have with an executive assistant. We help them acquire all kinds of assets and manage them, whether it's real estate, private aviation, private, you know, yachts and boats, wine collections, art collections, you name it. You know, those assets not only have to be acquired, they have to be managed and valued. So we look after a lot of those assets on behalf of our clients. We pay their bills. We keep their books. Probably, you know, the most important thing we do is manage their portfolios. So in the same way that a hedge fund would look to maximize return, you know, our mandate is to not only take that wealth and grow it over time, but also keep it safe. So we're looking to diversify as much as we possibly can. So in addition to traditional stocks and bonds, we're investing in hedge funds, private equity, real assets, you know, so infrastructure, timber, farmland. real estate. We're doing direct investments into companies, and in some cases, co-investing with other private managers. And then finally, we really kind of help them look to the future. So we're helping them with estate planning to maximize, you know, the assets that can be passed down to future generations. We work with them on philanthropy, right? I mean, the ultra wealthy are very charitable, but we want to make sure that they do it in a tax efficient way and that there's some structure around how they think about giving, that it's not just willy-nilly to whoever asks for it, but if they want to have an impact, let's define the cause that they care about, and then let's maximize those charitable donations. And then finally, things we call family services. So succession planning, good governance, making sure they have at least an annual meeting and that we're developing a robust agenda that you know, goes over the portfolio and the family business. But more importantly, we bring in outside subject matter experts, and we do a lot of education, right? Not just for the, you know, the matriarch and the patriarch, but their kids and their grandkids and the whole family on a host of topics. So it's incredibly exciting and really a lot like hedge funds. I get up every day. I know there's going to be some curveballs thrown my way, and I'm just hoping that I'm going to not strike out, right?
And I bet you don't either. That's great. So these, I'm assuming that it's 25 million minimum is your sweet spot, or I guess your sweet spot is 100 million, because that's kind of the look at how much money they need to spend to be able to afford all those different products.
Yeah, you know, it differs. You know, some folks may have less than 25 million, but maybe they own a family business that's not liquid right now, right? But part of what we do in a lot of cases is help them to have conversations about planning a business exit. Right. You know, with private equity and SPACs out there with, you know it best. I mean, blank checkbook and lots of dry powder. You know, companies are being acquired at a rate that we haven't seen in years. And so there's a lot of times where there's that knock at the door, and you need to be prepared on multiple levels for someone to offer you more money than you ever thought you'd be able to take in for your family business. And so sometimes, you know, the number grows over time when they sell a business. Or once again, as families change, as people, unfortunately, father time is undefeated, right? So people pass away. And then as assets pass on to the next generation, if people have more than one child, then you start to see family fortunes spreading out. So as a family unit, the number is still a very large one, but then you have subfamilies, right? And so for us, we manage the larger family relationship, but then we have to manage each individual subfamily as their own unit, because they have different things that matter to them. They may have different charitable interests. They may have different spending habits or different areas of focus. So it's exciting, really, for us to kind of go through the generations with our families and get to know the next generation, in some cases, Gen 3, their kids or grandkids, and see the wealth and how it's passed down and how it's used over the years.
Yeah. I mean, it's important because you want to make sure that the families don't just, the second generation just spends everything, you know. So we're both in Tiger 21, and that's a lot of what they talk about. And that's kind of the founding of how Tiger 21 was started, was Michael Sonnenfeld up in New York. You know, he sold his business and wanted to make sure that he knew how to invest, you know, philanthropy. How do you give it away? How do you talk to your kids about it? How do you make sure your kids don't just get it and spend it? I got one guy that I was talking to the other day, and he's a Tiger member. And he said, I said, well, what do you do about your kids? And what if your kids get your wealth? He goes, I don't care. I'm not here anymore. I don't care. They can spend it, but they can. And I mean, they're great kids, and I'm sure they're not going to spend it all. And they're going to invest it and do things that he's talked to them. But he's like, I don't care. They can spend it. I'm not here anymore. I mean, I was like, well, that's pretty good information, but I'm sure that the kids would appreciate some more, you know, direction on, okay, well, I don't want to spend it all. I want to have it forever. I want to give some to my kids, but I want to be able to earn enough to, you know, live off of it and also, you know, have it be multi-generational. So that's a big thing. So anything in particular in trends that you're seeing right now, is there anything in particular people are investing in? Is real estate, I mean, man, real estate has made so many people so much money in the past 3, 5, 10, 15 years. Is it going to keep going up? Is there is oil and gas. Do you see oil and gas going up? I mean, that's a self-directed, you know, question here. But what are you seeing trend-wise?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And I think the pandemic in particular has forced everyone to take a real hard look at their portfolios and how they're currently positioned and how they're going to look towards the future. You know, you bring up real estate. You know, we continue to have some real estate exposure. We think that actually, you know, funny enough, we had some commercial real estate exposure going into the pandemic. And you can imagine that was one of the first areas of focus for us, just given the lockdowns and everybody working from home and companies moving to a more flexible, you know, work from home schedule meant probably companies not needing the same office footprint that they did in the past. We were really lucky that the manager that we had partnered with actually had exposure to a lot of what I will call not your LA and New York and Chicago, but more second tier regional cities. They were already seeing the trend of people relocating to many of those cities. A great example is just in your backyard of Austin, Texas. I can remember when I would go down to meet with the pension funds and government entities in Austin, and it was all, you know, finance and, you know, to a lesser extent, oil and gas. But obviously Houston is more of Houston and Dallas are more the center of activity there. But over the last 10 years, you know, Austin has become a technology hub. And I think that we're seeing that as a trend where Texas is, you know, let's face it, Texas and Florida, from a taxable standpoint, are better states for a lot of these folks. And we saw that this mass migration, if you will, of people from kind of the technology corridor in Silicon Valley and California up near San Francisco starting to migrate to cities like Austin. Because of the quality of life, because, you know, obviously cheaper housing, better taxes, and this, you know, the energy around the tech community down there. So we were really lucky that, you know, our particular investment was already positioned in some of those cities that really benefited from the pandemic. And we continue to think that, you know, on the distress side of things, you know, we may see, you know, some, you know, the bubble may pop here at some point in real estate. And that always is where we're looking to stick our hand out, just like a hedge fund would, and find opportunities. Specifically, a couple of areas that we're focused on. So, you know, we're worried about, like many people, the 60-40 portfolio of, you know, 60% stocks and 40% bonds. You know, stocks are at incredible valuations right now. Some say too high. On the fixed income side, rates are very, very low, right? So you think about that inverse relationship, right? Bond prices are at all-time highs, they don't seem like they could go much higher unless yields go into negative territory. So what do you buy, right? If you can't buy stocks and bonds, then you got to focus on alternative investments. And so, you know, once again, private markets, hedge funds, real assets. For us, infrastructure is an area of focus. We believe not only because the current administration is focused on it, you know, America needs to be rebuilt in a lot of ways. We've got a lot of our core infrastructure that's just getting to an age where it needs to be repaired and replaced. We also see that, you know, as inflation starts to enter the conversation, that infrastructure obviously can be a good inflation hedge. And so definitely putting a big area of focus there. And then just private market investing, whether it's private equity or private debt in particular, you know, with yields as low as they are, we're trying to find alternative yields in the marketplace where we can lend and not increase our risk profile, but get obviously more than we would get in the government treasury market, which is, let's face it, close to zero right now. So really, you know, it's forcing that investment team here at Verdant's to go out and really do their homework to find interesting deals and opportunities for our families.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. And I mean, the stock market, I mean, I remember when the stock market was a little over 1,000 and now it's at 34,400, 500, 34,000. I mean, I remember it was, I think the October 19th, 1987 crash when I was a stockbroker back then. It was 1,800, I believe. It went to 1,400 or went down 25% in one day. And I mean, that's just, I mean, the stock market is, but you can't, I say you can't not or double negative invest because, man, it just keeps going up and up and up. You don't think Apple is going to go to $1 trillion? Oh, yes. Do you think it's going to go to $2 trillion? I mean, at Amazon, same way. I mean, it just goes up and up and up and up. And I just think that an oil and gas business, if we can buy solid assets that are producing, put a little bit of money into them and sell them in a year, 2 years, I think that's the best way right now to beat anything that's out there in the market. And I'm here to show you I'm going to do it. But that's a different day, a different topic. And we'll be talking about that, you know, in our other webinars that we have. But oil and gas assets go up, and there's a lot of people out there right now that are dumping a lot of oil and gas deals. I just got a guy sitting here. I said, hey, offer him $500,000. I mean, it's like a $3 million deal. $3 million deal, and he's going back and forth. And I said, hey, I'll offer him $500,000. I mean, do the same thing on another deal that I bought. I'm closing on at the end of next week. It was like $4.5 million. I bought it for $1.2 million. You know, I mean, there's assets out there. And what you do is you do the same thing that we do with real estate. I got a friend of mine that does loans money to houses. So when he finds the guys that want to do the work on the houses, and he'll have a guy go over and look at it and go, okay, well, this house, you shouldn't pay more than $200,000 for this house, and don't put more than $100,000 in it. So you got $300,000 because it's going to sell for $400,000. I mean, you can see the future on that. Same thing. We're doing the same thing with oil and gas assets in our fund we have right now with Six. So let me ask you another question. That was a advertisement for Jay Young King Operating. But anyway, what about the pandemic? What happened during the pandemic, or what? How did that affect you the most? And what do you see? Are we ever going to get out of this thing? People are still wearing masks.
Yeah, no, it you know, it's not over, obviously, but it feels a little bit like we can see the light at the end of the tunnel. I mean, I remind our clients consistently that you have to remember the United States, and obviously I'm biased because I'm a proud American, but we're in first place, right? I mean, nobody has the vaccination rate that we have. And most countries have not been able to open up to the extent that we have. And as a result of that, I really think that if you look geographically, you know, from an economic perspective, the U.S. is going to lead the way coming out of this. But going into it, boy, to your point, we saw some really interesting trends. I mean, the first one, I mean, I think everyone thinks of the ultra affluent, that none of them fly commercial, which is actually a lie. I'd say on average, it's about 50% of wealthy families that I work with either own a private jet or charter a jet or have a jet card. And, you know, obviously that's part of what we do, right? We do the analysis for them on where do they fly? How often do they fly? How many people? And then we're able to effectively calculate, does it make sense for you to do this? And if you're going to do it, then you should buy a fraction, or you should buy a jet, or maybe if you're using it for business, then there's some tax benefits there. But a lot of the 50% that said, listen, they got wealthy because, you know, they didn't spend a lot of money. And they said, it just doesn't, you know, that whatever it is, 10 times the cost to fly privately, I just don't believe in it. I'll buy a first class ticket and fly Delta or United. Those people in the pandemic, number one, they still wanted to get to that third, fourth, fifth property, but they didn't want to fly commercially. They didn't want to sit next to somebody and potentially get sick. So a lot of those folks came back to us and said, all right, can you help me think through not only the cost benefit analysis, but, you know, which of those options should I be considering from a private aviation standpoint? So it's not surprising to me that companies like Wheels Up and NetJets have been absolutely killing it over the last, you know, call it 18 months, because people that would have never bought their services lined up in droves. So that's one, that's a big one. You know, the other thing I'd say is just, there was a real focus with our families on, you know, internally on taking care of themselves, you know, on multiple levels. So the first one is cyber. And we just saw that obviously in the oil and gas industry with the recent pipeline hacking. I mean, hacking activity has gone off the charts during the pandemic. And so, you know, I tell people it's a little bit like being on the plains of Africa, right? You know, when you're an antelope, you don't have to be the fastest antelope, but you can't be the slowest, right? Or the lion's going to get you. So we're constantly telling our families, you've got to make sure that you've got good cyber hygiene. And so, well, we'll bring in experts and really kind of do an assessment of where they are, both professionally and personally with a lot of those home devices, as people were working and studying from home, they opened up a lot of additional vulnerabilities because they didn't have that professional IT team to help keep them safe. On the healthcare front, you know, we saw a rise in what I would call concierge medicine, right? When there's not a pandemic, people don't care that you know, call their doctor and can't get an appointment for 3 months. But when you're worried about something like COVID-19, you know, people want to be able to call their doctor and get a test like that. And so having a doctor on call, and concierge medicine is also another thing like private aviation where the demand is going up. People want that doctor. They pay a set fee to every year. And then if I need you, I want to text you and hopefully I'll hear back within, you know, 15 to 30 minutes. And then the last one, as far as taking care of is really personal safety and security. You know, there's been obviously the you know, civil unrest has been on the rise throughout the pandemic and people don't feel safe. So we bring in a lot of, you know, ex-military and ex, you know, police folks to help consult with our families on not just, you know, home safety, making sure that the home is well protected, that you have the security system that you know you've talked about and you have a plan as far as if somebody were to come knocking one day. But then also as things open up, people start to travel again, thinking about, you know, just being more what I call, you know, situational awareness, right? Just kind of, as they say in the military, watching your six when you're going down that street in some foreign country, someone could be following you and up to no good. And if your head's on a swivel and you're always kind of thinking about where you are and who's around you, then, you know, you're going to be in a better place than once again, that the slowest antelope on the plane, so to speak. Hey, I'll share this with you and your listeners. Talked to a security expert recently, and this was a tip that I used years ago when I used to travel the world for on the hedge fund side. But one of the cheapest and most powerful ways to stop an invasion in a hotel room, you take one of those little door stoppers that we all have in our homes and businesses, pack that in your suitcase. And when you go into a hotel room, you just jam that thing under the door. And then if somebody has one of the devices where they can get into an electronic card reader hotel room, they're not going to be able to open the door because, believe me, trust me, Jay, try that sometime. Put that thing under a door and then try to get through that door.
Oh, I got you, man.
Good luck to you.
Yeah. Excuse me. That's funny. That's good. I like that. Hey, so what if when you look into your crystal ball, any predictions for the future? What do you think?
Well, hopefully, as we just talked about, we continue to see things reopening. I do believe that markets have gotten to a point, whether it's real estate, traditional stocks and bonds, everything feels very, very frothy. You know, let's face it, global central banks had to react to the pandemic, flooded the system with liquidity. And just like we saw after the great financial crisis in 07, 08, what happens with all that cheap money out there, you know, assets obviously go to new highs. So I'm not saying there's going to be a crash tomorrow, but at some point the markets have to pull back. So we're telling our clients, you know, keep some dry powder out there because we would see those pullbacks as buying opportunities. But then the other thing to think about, you know, with the new administration in Washington is, you know, taxes are only going in one direction over the next couple of years, right? So we were telling clients even before the election, we didn't know obviously who was going to win, but we said, it's always good to be prepared. So, you know, sitting down with your estate attorney, making sure you have the right structures and everything are funded, and just buttoning up that estate plan, I think is really important because as I said, you know, taxes are probably only going to go in one direction. And then the other thing I think is going to be really interesting is that as people have kind of moved around the country in this work from home, study from home environment, and as I mentioned earlier, a lot of our clients going to places like Florida and Texas, it'll be really interesting to me on a state level. So let's say you have a job in New York, but you've been living in Florida for a year and a half. You know, are you going to pay taxes in Florida? Are you going to pay taxes in New York? You got to think that New York is going to come after some of those folks, right? And say, no, you're still working in New York, even though it's virtually. I know that your rear end is in Florida, but I think it's going to be really interesting. And so, you know, we're telling clients if they're not sitting down with professionals like us and making sure they're getting sound tax advice, You absolutely should, because the Biden administration has said they are committed to not only raising taxes, but also they're dumping, a ton of money into the IRS, which has been largely underfunded and has been shrinking for the last 10 years. And so as more funding heads towards the IRS, they're hiring more people. We expect audit activity to actually go up pretty significantly in the years to come. So you got to make sure it's got to be belts and suspenders on everything that you're doing, because you have to assume that, the tax man's going to come calling and you will be audited. So make sure you're doing everything the right way.
Right, right. And I know a lot of my clients continue to be, wow, what's going to happen? We're piling on debt and we're buying all the 500 million shots from Pfizer. I mean, we're just adding debt and debt and debt, and it's not going down anytime soon. And it's going to catch up with us in the future, but if you invest in oil and gas, you do get a write-off. Anyway, another commercial for Jay Young. Let's talk about the last thing here is what are your top priorities as your legacy? What would you like to be known for?
Well, it's a great question, and I'm glad you asked it, because it's something really that we work with our clients almost daily on. Hmm. We talk about, what do you want your legacy to be? And my answer is the same as most of our clients and probably most people, right? It's really twofold. It's number one, my children, right? I've got two great kids, a 12-year-old and a 14-year-old, boy and a girl, and I love them dearly. I think my wife and I have done hopefully a pretty darn good job raising them, and the schools that they go to here in Baltimore have helped along the way. So really, when I think about my legacy, certainly first and foremost, it's my kids and really making sure that in addition to the education they're getting at school, that my wife and I are doing a good job in raising good human beings. We want our kids, we give back, we want our kids to really appreciate not only giving back financially to charities, but also, really kind of, when I think about like what I'm doing here, which is imparting knowledge to others, giving back with your time, not just with your checkbook. And then philanthropy, right? I mean, I've mentioned it several times. A lot of folks, when they think about their legacy, want to have an impact on the world through charity. And my family's no different. We set up our own family foundation back about 13 years ago when my 14-year-old daughter was born. At about age 5 months, unfortunately, she was diagnosed with a rare form of epilepsy. And by the grace of God, we were blessed to be here in Baltimore. She was treated at Johns Hopkins and made a full recovery. But a lot of kids in her position don't make that recovery and have to live with it for the rest of their lives. So we set up the Carson Harris Foundation as a charitable entity to help fund research and support education around epilepsy, and in particular, some of the alternative therapies, diet-based therapies that, like my daughter went through, that really saved her life. And we live in a world where everybody thinks, that there's a magic pill that will solve every illness. And there's a lot of great medications out there, don't get me wrong, but there's other things that can help people. And so that's another part of my legacy, is hopefully our family foundation can make a difference in the lives, particularly young people who are diagnosed with various forms of epilepsy.
Wow, that's great. That's great. I mean, what a great segment. I'll tell you what, I gotta wrap it up. I don't want people to lose interest, and I want people to really think about the things that we talked about today. And the biggest things that we shared was, how do you get on Wall Street? What does that look like? How what's the best way? And you shared some great ideas on what to do to get on Wall Street, how to get a job, how to get an interview, how to get a job. What does a mentor look like? What does a mentor do? You've had great mentors. Now you're mentoring other kids. Now it's all coming back. You talked about the family office, and what is a single family office, a multi-family office? Talking about, what do you do to take care of families with wealth, and what do they need, and how do they need to function, right? And a lot of good predictions on the markets and what's going to happen in the future. I didn't hear about the price oil there, but I'm not going to hold you to a price, we'll talk about $100 oil anytime you want to talk about where's the price of oil going in the future and how can you make money in oil and gas. But, what great interview, Michael. I'll tell you what, It's been a great time with you. We spent a lot of great time, a lot of great points. You know, Gettysburg College all the way down to Campbell to managing a $14 billion hedge fund. That is very, very, that is, accomplishment is unbelievable. And I can't believe, I mean, the amount of accountability you've had, the struggles you've had to get there. You know, congratulations to you. And it's been really an honor to have you on the show and do this interview.
Thanks, Jay. I'm looking forward to getting together in person at some point. Maybe my Baltimore Orioles, the next time they play the Texas Rangers, we can get together and share a beer.
That'll be great. Right now, we used to have a lot of the Texas Rangers that went to the Baltimore Orioles, and then now I go to some Ranger games, but it's been kind of ugly here the last 20 games. But we won last night in San Francisco in the 11th inning. But anyway, yes, I definitely agree with you. Also, our Tiger meeting is next February 14th, I believe, in Scottsdale. We're having our – I don't know if you're planning on attending or not, but I'm definitely going to be there.
I will be there, Jay.
I love the annual meetings that we have. They're always fun, whether they're in Arizona 1 year, Florida the next. They go back and forth, but it's always great. Anyway, Michael, thank you so much for being on today. It's been awesome, and I appreciate that. Make sure you hit the button down below, subscribe to the Jay Young Show. Get a hold of Michael and his company. If you want to get a hold of you, how do we get a hold of you, Michael?
We've got a great website with more information. So it's www.verdancefamily.com.
Verdancefamily.com. Great, great. That's awesome. And I tell you what, there's no question that Michael will not spend time and listen and reply back. I know him. I know that he'll reply back to any question. Don't worry about it. If you want to look for a job on Wall Street, or you just have a question about what's a family office, can you go over that again? I mean, I'm sure that he would be glad to answer those. So thank you so much for being on. Next time on the Jay Young Show, not sure who we're going to have on next time. I'm looking at Mark Cuban and Greg Lippman and Nolan Ryan, Jessica Brothers, put Michael Harris into that mix right there. And man, I tell you what, it's always fun. Thanks, Michael. And thank you, everybody. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks, Jay.